Thank you, Elaine. I'm really excited to follow Michelle. Michelle and I were saying it before the session started that these are complex topics to talk about, and I realize now what my talk has been missing all these years that I've struggled to give it is an introduction by Michelle, because what I'm going to say is very consistent and builds on what she said and looks at it in a slightly different angle. So the topic of my talk is behavioral theories and health disparities research. Where do we go from here? Do we use the wheel or the... There we go. Okay, I too have no relationships to disclose. My work, as Elaine said, has been in cancer disparities, and I'm going to start this talk on a rather down note, and that is that a very recent report has come out, a very well-done analysis that tells us not only have cancer disparities not decreased in the 20 years that research has been going on to address this problem, a set of problems, but in fact, disparities, cancer disparities are projected to increase dramatically by the year 2030, due primarily to the aging of the population and the continued diversification of the population. As you can see, cancer disparities are projected to increase 99% for minorities, communities of color, versus 31% for in Anglo population. So this is a really distressing picture, and to me what it says is that we really need some major paradigm shifts in the way we are doing our research. The good news is that things are changing in our field, and particularly because of the types of things that Michelle described to you. We are very gradually getting away from the exclusive focus on the individual, and even though in these meetings, in our books and papers, we talk about this extensively, constantly, if you sit on review committees, if you review manuscripts, you know, it's still coming around, the individual level focus, and if you've written a paper using the health belief model, you better hope that I'm not a reviewer, because we've been there and done that. But increasingly, we are expanding our understanding of determinants of health behavior and of health outcomes. And slowly, we are using these expanded understandings to inform our interventions. And as Michelle said, we're talking more about social context and trying to understand the implications of social context for behavior and intervention. And we have shown a willingness to acknowledge and embrace and confront the complexity that is human behavior. So one problem, though, that still remains is that we need a more contextual approach to culture. When we're talking about disparities, we are necessarily talking about diversity, ethnic diversity, and cultural diversity. So I want to talk for a moment about how we got to where we are in order to think about how we can move beyond the old paradigms. First of all, I'm sure as most or all of you know, our field of studying health behavior and health determinants has really been dominated in its methods and its theories by biomedicine and also methods appropriate for epidemiology and health psychology, but not necessarily appropriate for understanding culture and social context. And so our theories have been predominantly psychological in their methods and theories, with an emphasis, I think you used the word mentalness, emphasis on cognition and quantitative measures. And we extensively use survey-based methods and randomized controlled trials. That still remains the gold standard if you look at any reviews or our current journals. And the emphasis has been on deductive methods and internal validity. But where that has gotten us is that culture has been relegated to the background or reduced to a limited set of variables and scales. Our behavioral theories are ones that were developed among mainstream Anglo populations, tested predominantly among university students, and applied as if they were universal to diverse disparities populations. So we take the constructs of the theory of planned behavior or the health belief model or on and on and on. We translate them and we put them into surveys, and that's what we use to try to understand behavior. What we end up with is an array of, this is not what we end up with from there, but in addition, our field is exemplified by an array of disconnected findings of intervention efficacy. We have an intervention that'll attempt to increase breast cancer screening among Latinos using lay health workers, and one study design and set of measures over here. Another that uses a completely different approach and a slightly different population. And so the way I like to characterize our field overall is that it's like a galaxy. We have brilliant points of light punctuated by vast empty spaces. We can't connect the dots, and so we really can't begin to understand the mechanisms of these behaviors and our interventions. And so we have little understanding of how and why our interventions work or don't work, and limited external validity. We end up developing interventions that we may be able to say that the trial itself had integrity, but we don't know if it really is applicable in the real world. So we need to back up from this approach and start looking through a wide-angle lens at behavior and health disparities instead of through the microscope at different components and influences and determinants of behavior. I don't think I need to tell anybody in this room what this slide says, that the sociocultural forces that shape people's day-to-day experience and which directly and indirectly affect behavior is what we are calling social context. And it is a very complex environment, and it's very dynamic. And that's the reason that the kinds of methods that we've used really have not fit with this sort of perspective on health and health behavior. These are some of the components of social context: socioeconomic opportunity, individual dependence or interdependence. What that means is societies where the rugged individualist predominates versus a more collective orientation, migration experiences, spiritual religious orientation, and history. These are very different dimensions. I'm talking about apples and oranges here, intentionally. And these things are all the components of our social context, and they interact with one another in very dynamic ways to result in the way we see things, the way we see them, and the way we do what we do as far as our health is concerned. So culture is an aspect of social context. And culture governs and yet is influenced by social context. These are very interactive phenomena. The way we've defined culture, and everybody has different definitions, but they all have certain commonalities. Culture is the pattern processes of people making sense of their world, and the conscious and unconscious assumptions, expectations, knowledge and practices they call upon to do so. And I really want to emphasize the unconscious aspects of culture, because if you're trying to get at culture through surveys and focus groups, you're not tapping those unconscious influences that come to us from generations. I always like to think about it in a term. I'm a very, I'm a professional, I'm highly educated, but my Latvian grandmother speaks to me from somewhere. And that is just in the mix of how I see the world. And I know that that's true for all of us, and yet we can't really tap into or explain that part of how we live. So this is in contrast to culture as measurable beliefs, such as fatalism. So we've tried to look at behavior in isolation from this context, and very much the way a laboratory scientist would look at cells. Many types of cells can be kept alive and studied in isolation from their tissue or organ of origin. But what if such isolation distorted, disguised, or concealed the cell's most important properties? I think that's what we've been doing in terms of our study of behavior. But we really need to understand culture out of context. Culture does not exist outside of context. Cultures must be viewed as a whole fabric where the study of individual threads reveals little or nothing of the texture or style of the whole. So I worked for 10 years, the first 10 years of my research career. I was involved in large-scale randomized trials of ethnically diverse populations, mainly looking at screening behavior, trying to predict and understand behavior with our surveys and testing our interventions in randomized trials. And I dutifully applied the theories that have dominated the cancer screening literature. But after 10 years of this, of really being in communities, African American, Latino, Chinese, Filipino, these theories were not working for me. They weren't anywhere close to what I was observing in the real world. And so I started reading and exploring outside of the public health literature. I started reading in anthropology and social psychology and sociology. And I started to read things that made more sense and helped explain what I was seeing in communities. So I started moving in my own work toward a more contextual paradigm, one that uses inductive exploration through anthropologic methods, where multiple forms of qualitative inquiry are used. If you just do focus groups with members of the community, you are getting one dimension of a very multi-dimensional picture. And what anthropologists never do that. Ethnography means collecting data from multiple perspectives, from going out and observing with your own eyes, from talking to informants who are professionals or mid-level people in the community, leaders in the community, and lay people. So you're collecting different perspectives that any one group cannot have and cannot talk about. I started working with transdisciplinary research teams. I brought together anthropologists with psychologists and professionals in medicine and public health and biostatisticians. Together, we were able to take a very different sort of look at behavior. And we were able to go beyond quantification of patterns and prevalence to ask what is happening, how is it happening, and why. In other words, we were blending methodologies and paradigms. Mixed methods means, in my mind, inductive and deductive research paradigms working together, quantitative and qualitative methods, building on the strengths of both of those. So, 2 minutes. Really quickly, and this is written up. I'll give you the citation. This is the approach that informed the study. People are always sort of grousing about the theories. Well, you know, they just don't seem to work in my community. Well, we actually did a study to interrogate and assess the cultural appropriateness of the major behavioral theories constructs from the theories that are used in cancer screening. And this was a basic behavioral study looking at self-efficacy, intention, and the others that you see there. We used mixed methods. We had a multilingual survey, a prospective survey with a cohort of women from 5 different race ethnic groups. And we used several different types of qualitative and inductive methods. My team was really a transdisciplinary team, as I described a moment ago. And I'm going to just take you really quickly through our findings on one of the most dominant constructs of our time, and that's the construct of intention. This is from the NCI, National Cancer Institute, website. It says, most theories of health behavior share a belief that the single best predictor of an individual's behavior is simply his or her intention. I'm sure if you're here in this room to learn about theory, you know about the construct of intention. Many studies even use intention as the main outcome. That's how powerful a determinant, how closely linked it's thought to be with actual behavior. So we asked, is intention comparable in meaning and measurement across cultures? And this is the quantitative part of our study. It came from a survey from an ongoing intervention trial that we were doing at the same time as this study. Basically, what you're looking at here, excuse me, is intention measured at baseline, women saying, I intend to get a mammogram in the next 12 months, and then whether or not they actually got screened at the time of the follow-up survey. And as you will see, as you can see here, the only subgroup for whom intention predicted mammography longitudinally were white women. That was not the case for the other race ethnic groups. The details of this study are in the monograph. I'll tell you about it at the end. So we used a variety of inductive qualitative methods. Excuse me. We interviewed scholars from the Filipino and Latino culture, community gatekeepers from those communities, and we did interviews with women. I'm sorry. So we identified through thousands of pages of transcripts these major domains of social context. And a social capital, which is one that Michelle mentioned, relational culture and transculturation. I'm not going to go into all of these, thank you. But I will just say that in identifying these domains as major factors of women's daily lives, we then were able to analyze the constructs through the lens of these social context domains. The themes that were related to intention are that the meaning of stated intention, for many reasons, including the subtleties of indirect communication, people will say yes, but mean no. Now that alone can explain the findings that we found quantitatively. But this is all part of communication dynamics that you can't really get at with our usual methods. I'm not going to go through all of these because I'm out of time. But we found also women were willing, there were so many different ways that intention didn't work the way the theories predicted. Women would form an intention to get a mammogram in the absence of theorized beliefs or knowledge. So we had women who said, well, I will get a mammogram, but I don't want to be looking for cancer, you know. So, and there were a lot of broader reasons why that was true. So here are the conclusions that we came to regarding intention. The construct should not be used as universal due to differences in the meaning of stated intention, differences in the relationship of intention to behavior, missing predictors, and entirely different issues and relationships that are not present in the theories at all. So all of this is written up in a special supplement of Health Education and Behavior, 7 papers and 5 commentaries, and I'm deeply grateful to Elaine Auld and Sophie for helping us to bring this study to press in this way. And I want to close by saying that in the beginning, there were paradigm wars between the qualitative and the quantitative, and a relentless focus on the difference. And each side, the social scientists, the statisticians claimed the superiority for their methods, and most of all warned that they could not and should not be combined. But I think today we are now open to a blending of these paradigms and methods, and we're really going to be able to get much closer to what is true by doing this. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. But I wanted to say that in the studies where we are blending qualitative with quantitative methods, where we're using qualitative approaches to inform and explain our findings of our randomized trial, and I'm not talking about process evaluation, reviewers are loving it. It detracts in no way. It adds depth and richness. So I really encourage you to do this. So embrace and explore culture and social context, accept the complexities, and together we will begin to really better understand behavior in the larger picture of health disparities. Thank you.